Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00048. Recorded on May 31, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Intergalactic Gray. Intergalactic Gray. Chapter 48.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
I am now officially back to work. Back to work after a long 4-day weekend. A long, expensive 4-day weekend. It seems always the case. When I'm not here at work, you know, doing the work a day Joe thing, doing the Dwayne Schneider of Post Arlen, Texas thing. I'm home, away from work, and spending money. I mean, money just flies the fuck out of my pockets. And it started out that way immediately, right? I took Friday off, just a day off to make a three-day holiday weekend, right? It was Memorial Day weekend this past weekend. I tacked on the Friday to the 3 days and make it a 4-day. That's kind of how I roll. And, you know, right out the gates, I got to working on the, quote-unquote uglyscape that is my yard. And I'm going to tell you, it's still a lot of everybody's fucking situation out here. I mean, very strange. You know, I had talked a few episodes back, you know, earlier in the spring, how spring in Texas is typically a very short transition out of winter into summer. There are, however, some years when you get an actual spring. And this is one of those years we're getting an actual spring, right? We're just about into June now, so we're only 3 weeks away from calendar summertime. And we are holding steady temperature-wise in the 80s, not into the 90s. You know, it might peak out in the 90s during the course of the week, but it hasn't been like steady 90s. You know, I'm accustomed to, you know, not just here in Texas, but in the South. Like I've lived in Georgia, for example. You get into April, you know, sometimes in March, it hits 90 and it just stays that way all the way like into October and sometimes beyond, you know. But we're not getting that this year. It's been very pleasant, very mild in terms of storms, not many coming through, and they're not typically that bad. I do know that Allen, Texas, which I mentioned recently in a previous episode, Allen, Texas, who had the infamous mass shooting at the, what do they call it? The outlet mall, Allen, I forget what it's even called. The outlet mall up in Allen. Shortly there, like within the next 2 weeks, they had a storm where they had, it was somewhere between ping pong size and tennis ball size hailstones come down. And I had a bunch of people who I'm friends with who live in Allen. They're putting pictures up online about that shit. And Allen's been getting it this year. They've been getting it. But outside of that, the storms have been kind of few, far between, and mild as they pass by. It's not really been a whole hell of a lot of rain. In fact, shit's already drying up. I've noticed certain grasses are just going fucking brown completely. Weeds are still proliferating. It's like word for weeds. They just don't stop whatever's going on. But, that's what weeds are. Blame it on Adam and Eve. If you know the story, raise your hand. Right? I'm not going to get into that right now. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is we've had a very temperate, a four-season type of spring up to this point. Remarkably, it happens once in a while. It's been very nice, but the ground has been horribly ugly. It's like grass don't really want to grow. If you have a manicured lawn with professional landscapers who are fertilizing the fuck out of it, that's different. But things that are just kind of like wild or semi-wild, like my yard is currently, like the grounds where I work, they're just like, it's basically your prairie grasses growing here in a field. And my job is not to make them beautiful and lush. It's just to keep them down and tamed, but by now, usually they're very full and green. Well, all five blends plus the weeds and shit and the cover, everything is just nice and green at this time of year usually. And then if it's going to go brown, it starts going brown in July. It's a lot of it's already going brown now, and it's ugly. But 2023 is turning out to be the fucking ugly scape year, and I think in retrospect, it'll probably remain as such. I don't see this changing at any point, because now we're getting into a dry time of the year. That may actually help the situation by killing off some of this fucking crap, but we'll see. But yeah, I started out my long weekend on Friday, right? The battle against the ugly scape, and my battle of it there, I'm actually doing landscaping, and I bring that up from time to time. And part of my landscaping, I did all this shit. I bought Roundup, which is like it's like against my religion. I fucking hate Monsanto as a corporation, and Roundup and what it's done. It's all bad. I don't want to get into all that right now, some other time perhaps, but I'm like anti fucking Roundup, anti Monsanto. But the weed situation has just been so horrible that I put in special requests at work to order up some of that shit so I could keep up. And then at home, it was basically a dead lawn, except for all the weeds that kept growing, right? So my St. Augustine grass on three quarters of my front lawn completely burnt the fuck up, right? And not coming back. Well, it was very slowly coming back. It's actually starting to make its comeback now. But after the fact, and what the fact is that I'm talking about is I got a jug of Roundup and I sprayed a particular area on my lawn that I wanted to kill off completely dead. Weeds, the St. Augustine's, everything. I just wanted nothing left of it, right? And I thought, well, fucking Roundup, man, that shit kills everything. It's the only thing that ever really worked. It don't work in Texas, I'll tell you that. It don't work on my fucking weeds, right? The Johnson grass, the Dallas grass. It's fucking nasty shit. You spray that thing right in the face and it just kind of like drinks it up, has a little acid trip and laughs, perpetual grin all night. Give me more, right? I sprayed that shit. And what you're supposed to do, basically, you spray it, you let it dry, and you give it a week or two, whatever. Watch it, die off, and then you just kind of rake it up, right? And then you got a dead lawn, a plot of dirt that you could start over. That's the ambition, to grow a new fucking lawn. I do all this shit, and it doesn't die. It doesn't die. So it's like I got to go out there by hand and do it. I got the dirt rake out. And like you dirt rake on baked fucking clay with Dallas grass growing out of it all over. Dallas grass, it has a rooting system, goes down and spreads out like a fucking tree, right? It goes out, then down, and you can't just pull it up. You got to dig it up. And you got to dig like 4, 5, 6 inches down to get under it lift the whole fucking thing up, and you got to go all the way around it. You know, you got to hit it with a spade like 6 times in a circle, and then try to prop it up. And there's still always some kind of straggler fucking roots holding on for dear life that will not relent. They will not give up. It's a lot of fucking work to take one of these things up, right? And then when you pull it up, you get this massive clump of clay, this black clay, which our area is known for, right? The black dirt region. And I don't want to lose all that fucking dirt. Yeah, you know, it's coming out of it's holes in the fucking ground, you know? So I had to do is make piles of all these weeds with all the clumps of dirt hanging off that I couldn't shake off. I'm beating the thing against the fucking shovel, and but still, the roots are wrapped around this thing so tight, you know? Oh, my God. It is from the devil. They call marijuana the devil's weed. Bullshit. Bullshit. This fucking Dallas grass is the devil's weed. Head to toe, top to bottom, side to side. I hate this shit. And it's everywhere, all the time. But I had to do this. I had to dig, I don't know, 100 of these fucking things or more. It don't look like much. Some of them are just kind of new and kind of flat. Some of them are all spread out and tall and obvious. But, you know, they're just all there. You got one of them, you got 10 of them. And I had to go through and just dig up all this shit. And I did 3 fucking big piles of them, right? I had to let out in the sun, let it all dry out so I could shake off the rest of the fucking dirt, bag it all up, leave it on the street for the garbage pickup, you know, and then sweep all the dirt back into the dirt section. So now I got an area of dirt, big circle around my new tree, basically. I threw down some, what do you call it? Peat moss, right? Peat moss, Canadian peat moss. To cover that area, and I'm expecting in a day or two for new pods of a particular type of St. Augustine grass come out of Florida. They're the 13 little 3x3 square, 13, 32 3x3 squares, like little starter pods of St. Augustine. St. Augustine's grows on runners sideways. So you got to do is get a couple of spots of them and just sit back and wait. And they'll grow laterally and end up covering up a whole area. It may take a little bit of time to get there, but with 32 of them, you know, probably, you know, if I keep it watered and everything and set it up right, maybe by the end of the season, I'll have the makings of a fucking lawn out there. It's not that big a section. And it's not that big a section. And but meanwhile, there's a little planter area I got up by the walkway up front that needs to be completely dug up because it's got so much of that fucking Dallas grass weed in it. But that's the portion where the dead St. Augustines came back to life like fucking Lazarus, right? And it's growing there. And I'm looking at it like, well, it's a lawn. If I take up the Dallas grass, I got a lawn back. But now it's going to be a different St. Augustine's than what I'm planting. And so I'm probably going to end up tearing that whole fucking thing up. And that's going to suck because that's a lot of runners and shit. It doesn't end. It doesn't end. But I bring all this up because it costs a lot of money, right? It cost me money. It cost me like $150 at Home Depot before I got started. Now, I bought a new dirt rake and I bought a new leaf rake in the process. And that's not much. That's like $30. The peat moss were $20 a sack. I bought 2 of those. That's $40. And I bought a bunch of stuff getting ready for that planter up front. The edges and that shit's expensive. Extra spikes for it. That shit's expensive. And, you know, I don't go into Home Depot without spending $150 every time I show up at that fucking place. And it doesn't seem like you get very much for it. Not in these days, not with the quote-unquote Bidenflation, where everything is anywhere from 33 to 66% more than it used to be just a couple of years ago. Everything except your salary, of course. Yeah, that pretty much stays the same. The battle with the ugly scape. But, yeah, I got done what I wanted to get done. I worked really fucking hard on Friday, right? And then I rested for a couple of hours. I took a nap, then I got up and showered, got dressed, and I went off to do some volunteer work, right? I did volunteer work. It seems like it's been a while. This is like you'd call it Christian ministry kind of stuff. It's an organization. I think they are headquartered out of Minnesota, which blows, but it is what it is. It's nationwide, and its services internationally. In fact, we were packing food for Kenya, as it was on Friday. Organization called Feed My Starving Children. They got some kind of, I guess you'd call it a production center over in Richardson, Texas. So I was over there for a couple of hours. A bunch of people from my church went down there, and I took part in that. My job was to basically shovel rice into a bin. Bin after bin after bin, you know. And wow, I got pretty good at that after a while. And so that's it. I did that, you know. And then I really didn't do a whole lot. I didn't do any other kind of work. I laid down very little effort the rest of the weekend. I really worked hard on Friday. I had to push myself to go show up Friday night because I was just, you know, dog shit tired. And then I get there and you know, I get home, and that was it. I really didn't want to do anything, even when I felt like I wanted to do something, you know. I had a little bit of get up and go, like Saturday morning right out the gate. I started to, like, I got up and got showered and started to get busy, and then I just faded really quick, you know. You know, the rest of the weekend wasn't much. We went out to, my wife and I, she just needed to get out of the house, right? She just needed to get out of the house. I was in the mood to just stare at the four walls all weekend and eat, you know, basically. But she needed to get up and out. So as a husband, it's my job to always find something to do when that moment in time comes up. So I found something that I'm surprised I never noticed before. I'm a big knife fan, as you all know. I collect knives, but I'm not like a collector of knives. I get like practical knives that I could do shit with, and I wouldn't say I'm bottom shelf in that regard. I'm somewhere midway. I'll spend $100 to $175 on a knife, and that's kind of where I max out. Anything beyond that price point is not practical to me. You know, you start getting in that area where you can get one knife for $200, you can get $200 knives. Or $450 knives. What would you rather do with your money, you know? I've had a couple of purchases that were over $150, and it turns out those knives are so nice at that price that I don't even really want to use them for anything, you know what I mean? That becomes collector shit, and I'm not a collector, really. I like a lot of tools. I like a lot of knives. Knives are tools, and every one of them has different purposes. I've been on this perpetual search for the perfect knife for my job, right? So every month or so, I get a knife. The intent is that it's going to be a beater, so I try to keep it down around $50. You know, something from Taiwan, not Chinese. Something with decent steel that I don't have to be sharpening every fucking week or two, which is hard at that price point, $50. You're not going to get that kind of steel usually. I've been using this Kershaw folding knife that retails around $80, American made, the SVN 35 steel, which is really good, right? I sharpened it on my new system 2 months ago, I think. Now I use it every single day, and it's kept that edge, and it's still sharp as fuck, you know. So that's kind of where I want to be at, you know. I think I need to be somewhere in that $80 range for a good SVN 35 knife, and then it's a matter of the design of the knife. Its practicality, its ease of use, shit like that. You know, can I just grab it out of my pocket, flip it open one hand, close it one hand? Does it cut the shit that I need to cut? Does it stay sharp? you know, and which blade shape is most effective for the range of usages that I have throughout the course of the day. So I'm always on this perpetual search for that knife, and I've had my eyes on a particular cold steel knife, which is known as a Recon 1. It's an old style knife. It goes back to the early 80s, and you know, once upon a time, that was the knife of choice for so many of our American soldiers, right? That'd be like their everyday carry knife. And usually it'd be some kind of clip point or drop point or something like that in style. But I got myself a Tanto, T-A-N-T-O, Tanto blade shape style cold steel Recon 1 with that SVN 30. I'm calling it 35. It's pretty sure it's 30. I don't know. My mind is kind of funky on me right now. I should know this because I'm always dealing with it, but here I will show it to you. It is S35VN. All right. I get it all kinds of mixed and matched. But yeah, I just snapped it open. You heard that. That means I bought one, right? That means I bought one. I've been eyeballing it for 2 or 3 months. I told the story of a prior model of a cold steel knife, the AD-10 that I purchased a couple of months back, which is a really good knife, really good knife. I wanted something a little lesser than that, but something almost as good, something somewhat cheaper, but something with this Tanto shaped blade. Why the Tanto shape? You'd have to go look it up yourself to see it, but you get an extra point on it, basically. The tip of it is almost like a chisel shape, and that's what I've been doing. I've been buying like these chisel tip shaped knives. I actually got a couple of them from, what the hell is the name? CRKT. Columbia River Knife and Tool, right? CRKT. They make a lot of decent lower end stuff, right? And I bought a couple of $40, say $50 knives. They're like mini, cleavers, right? I mean mini, like real small, right? Cleavers. So they have a cleaver edge and a cleaver spine. But down the front of it, they got a chisel tip also. I need to do some chiseling of shit on my job frequently, right? So it looked like a good match. Now, the first one I got also had a little serrated portion on the spine, which added to the coolness of it because I do minor electrical work. So I'd be, you know, cutting and splicing wires a lot. I got to peel that rubber coating off of it. It works good for that shit, right? But that one was so microscopically small, it was just hard for my hands to even deal with. My wife, when she saw it, she just automatically fell in love with it. She likes cleavers. She's a knife person, too, but she goes in for cleavers, and that was just her thing. So I gave that to her, and I ordered another one from the same company, from the same series, the same line. Razel is what it's called, R-A-Z-E-L, C-R-K-T, Razel. Line of knife models that are all more or less the same kind of design with odd little differences one to the next. And I got one that's pretty much the same thing, but significantly larger, still very small for me. But, you know, again, it has a straight edge, cleaver edge on one side of it, and then a front edge of it is a chisel edge, you know, and then it's got a thick spine. It looks like it would be a really good knife for my job. Problem is the sheath that comes with it. It's one of those Kydex sheaths, those plastic sheaths. And it takes effort to actually pull the knife out of this thing. And this thing doesn't have any adjustable screws for tension. It's a clip-on for your pocket. So you got an inside clip. You stick the whole thing inside your back pocket. It clips over into your jeans. And then you would hope to reach back, grab it. It's a fixed blade, right? Grab it and pull it right out of its sheath. Use it, be done, and pop it back. But when you go to pull it out of the sheath, the whole sheath comes unclipped from your pocket. So it becomes this whole jumble of shit. You know, you got to take it out of sheath with two hands. You got to put the sheath back in your pocket. Then you go do your work with the knife. Then you got to pull the sheath back out of your pocket to put the fucking knife back in the sheath, and then put the whole fucking knife and sheath back. It's right. You get the idea. Just talking it through is a labor. Actually doing it is worse. So now it's like, if I got a decent knife, I think, for the job, but now I have to go and make a sheath that's practical for it. I don't have time for that shit, so that knife is going to go sit in the Land of Misfit Toys pile until I get around to it, right? And this is what happens. Sometimes I strike out with these knives when I buy them. But the other one I had in mind for the job was this Tanto blade, the Tanto-shaped blade, cold steel, Recon 1. Which is similar in design. Its front edge is like a chisel, but instead of it being kind of like a, you know, paired off 90 degree angle, it's more of like a, ain't quite 45, maybe 55, 60 degree, but it's angled off. But it's enough that I could use it in a chisel manner. Also, where that chiseling edge meets its main edge, you have an additional point there. That additional point can be used for like cutting up packaging tape, duct tape, shit like that, without sinking the tip of the knife too deeply into a box and threatening to hack up whatever the contents are, right? Which happens to me a lot of my job. I'll stick a knife in there with its point and I'll end up cutting into whatever's inside of it. Because you're blind, you don't see how deep you gotta go and shit like that. So anyway, all that to say, I found a place online while I was looking for something to do out in Fort Worth. You know, it was about an hour ride out or so. Traffic wasn't that bad. It wasn't that bad of a ride. Good thing. I always like going out west, you know. I hate driving DFW, but I love heading out west in Texas. It just gives me this feel. And Fort Worth is different than Dallas. It's a whole different vibe out there. A better one as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, I found this place called House of Blades, right? Never heard of it before. Nobody's ever mentioned it to me before. So we went. We just, fuck it, let's go. I checked, it was open. We went on Sunday, I believe. And you go out there, the building seems like brand new. Everything's sterile inside. So it just seems like somebody like came from California and had this idea, because that's how so many of these businesses are popping up around here in post-Arlen, Texas, right? And put the, nah, this building has actually been there for like 20 something fucking years. It's just clean. However they do it, they might have revamped it somewhere along the way, but they've been at that site for at least 20 years, and they've been in business in the area of Fort Worth since like the early, what, 80s or late 70s or something like that. So it's nothing new. I just never managed to hear about it. So we went. We went just to go there. My wife likes knives. I obviously like knives. And we were walking around looking at knives and shit. And lo and behold, they had the one that I've had on my mind. This one, the Cold Steel Recon 1 I keep talking about. They had the Tanto Blade version of it, everything. You know, their prices were a little up. But I guess when you factor, if you order online, you got to pay shipping and everything. It's negligible, right? I might have ended up paying like an extra $10 for this. I think I got it there for $100 plus tax online. I think I've seen it a little bit cheaper than that. I had it in my mind that these things were probably more $85, $90 than you might have shipping and tax. It's negligible, you know. But there I was able to put it in my hand, you know, look at it and make a decision on the fly, you know. So I bought it. So this week I've been trying it out. Yesterday was my first day back here at work, and I used it exclusively, and man, I'll tell you what, it does the job. Having a little bit of issues with it. It's a little tight opening and a little tight closing too. It's got this kind of button unlocking system that is exclusive for cold steel. Works very nicely on my other knife. On this knife, it's kind of stiff. I guess I gotta break it in or something, or I might have to take it apart and sand down a little piece of it or some shit. I don't know. I'm not exactly happy with that. It is large, you know. It's a man size pocket knife, multi-use, multi-purpose, good everyday carry in general. I just got to kind of break it in a little bit. It's sharp. It's really, really sharp. Factory sharp is very sharp on this knife. So, yeah, we did that. House of Blades, you know. It was a group of kids that we were shopping through the aisles. They were basically the modern version of ordinary, like, Texas-style burnout kids, right? They were like teenagers shopping for knives, and they were oohing on over all the crazy-looking, like, switchblades and shit like that. You know how kids are when it comes to knives. They don't even, they're not even thinking of the blade. They're looking at all the bling and all that shit. And it was just good to see. Just for me, they were ordinary kids. Like, they were clearly burnouts. They were clearly from the wrong side of the tracks. You know, they weren't your ordinary, like, Biff and Buffy, upper middle class, suburban, California McMansion, DFW children, you know. They were kind of rough and tumble. You could tell that they were kind of burnout, but they weren't all rainbows and unicorns, if you know what I mean. They were just down to earth, like Texas redneck burnouts who were into knives and guns, and, you know, the boys are getting ready to go off to the army and shit. And it's just good for me to see. It was just something very normal about that. That's what I was saying. There's a different feel in the Fort Worth side of DFW than Dallas. Dallas has lost a lot of that quality. Things have gotten mishmash and weird, and I don't know what the rest of the weekend. Like I said, I did a lot of laying around, resting up, and eating. And when I'm eating, I'm watching something, you know, on the phone. And I mentioned prior episode about Star Trek Picard, right? The one of the new iterations of Star Trek out there. I was thinking it was in its fourth and final season now, which was soon to be released online on the Paramount Plus app, which I'm paying for by subscription just to see all the Star Trek stuff, because they own it. And it turned out, no, they put the third and final season up on that already, and that's what I was watching, you know? So I was suddenly done with it, and I thought there was a fourth season to come, but there ain't. There ain't. But, you know, I was into the second season when last I mentioned this stuff. I talked about Raritan 4, Raritan, New Jersey, the relation between the two, and but that was right at the beginning of the second season. As you got, I guess it was towards the end of the second season, there was the moment that I dreaded, right? This is what I hate about getting involved, like binge watching and getting involved with any kind of entertainment in the modern era. There seems to be some kind of requirement by fucking Satan's law of theatrical production that there has to be some kind of tip of the cap to this whole homosexual thing that is being imposed upon American society proper. And I've been just dreading getting involved in any of these Star Trek series that are more modern, current. Even like the movies that I've watched, anything that's getting around 2020 and beyond, right? It's few and far between. You know, Picard is one. Strange New Worlds is the one I really like. I'm waiting for more of that to come out. But that's, again, very modern. And I'm expecting a lot of rainbows and unicorns and butterflies and shit like that in there. Star Trek otherwise up to this point has been pretty fucking good about that, as far as I'm concerned, right? That's not really been an issue. But lo and behold, you had the long-awaited lesbo kiss scene in Star Trek. It had to happen. And oh, my shoulders slumped and my head hung low, right? There's some a couple of the main characters of going through into the second season of Star Trek Picard suddenly had the big on-screen lesbo kiss. You kind of felt it coming, you know? The way these scenes were unraveling, these two were always off doing something together while the rest of the team was off doing something else. And you just kind of had the feeling that it was going to go there, and it went there. It went there. And now I'm just thinking, like I said, my shoulders slumped, and I was like about to give up. I was just getting really into this shit. I thought it turned out that Star Trek Picard was really cool. Really cool, really inventive, really creative. It was moving well. There was a lot of subplots, and it was good. And now it's going to change over, because now you got the instigation of this reprobate relationship unfolding, which is obviously going to have to be an ongoing storyline the rest of the way. All right, there's no way to just have a kiss and then fizzle that shit out and act as if nothing happened. Now it's going to be part of the storyline. So every episode, there's going to have to be some LGBTQ plus shit, you know, mixed into the story to appease the minions of Satan out there. But no. They had a kissing scene, and then I think they ended the season kind of on that note, and then they began into the third and final season. I thought there was four, but no, it was third and final. And right off the bat, they moved it up a year or two in time. They dissolved the relationship between these two. They had a relationship and had broken up, but they're back together. But they were not going to carry on a storyline based on that shit, right? So Star Trek tipped the cap, but they didn't pour the baby out with the bathwater, right? So, okay, I was able to watch the rest of it. And the rest of it ended up being, fan service for Star Trek The Next Generation, right? I noticed along the way, as I'm watching episodes through season one and season two, a lot of the production team were the actors from Star Trek The Next Generation back in the 90s, right? And you're thinking, well, they're all working like as directors and producers, and you start seeing like little cameo appearances by some of these actors showing up in certain scenes. You get the feeling somewhere along the way they're just going to break it open and bring the whole fucking cast back and go out on some space mission, right? And that's what they did. That's what they did in the third season. And that's known as fan service, because if you're a fan of Star Trek The Next Generation and 30 years have gone by, all these actors are getting old, you know? None of them have died yet. Here's your chance, all right? Here's your chance to bring them all back together for one last hurrah. Do it before it's too late, right? The Sopranos, right? Was it James Gandolfini who played Tony Soprano, the main character? They stopped that show, and then there was whispers about like bringing it back in some other iteration or making movies, but then he up and had a heart attack and he's gone. How the fuck do you do Tony Soprano without that guy? Right? They do it in prequels and shit like that. But now sequels are going to be messed up. You always got to be comparing it against the great one. You know, it's hard to do. Maybe not enough time goes by, but we'll see. We'll see. They did one prequel movie I mentioned a long time ago. And I don't remember them having a lesbian kiss in that one. Go figure. They took another attitude to appease the fucking globalist demons, but a whole nother story right there. What was fun? So you get the fan service, right? Fan service is when you're basically giving your fan base what they want, what they expect, what they need. And they did it. They did it to the hilt. They just said, fuck this. You know what? We're going to bring a whole cast back. We're going to make a mission. They're going to save the whole galaxy. And it was really funny because they're all old and gray, right? Their actors are all gray and fat. Not all of them. Not all of them have gotten fat or anything like that, but, you know, you get the sagging skin on the face and the gray hair. They're old, you know, it is what it is. You can't really much work around that fact. Like, you could take a young actor and make them up to look older, but you can't take an old one and make them look younger. It doesn't really fly. And they didn't bother. They just, all right, you're old, we're older now, and now we're going to go out and save the galaxy as a bunch of old people. So it's kind of, you got these gray beards basically out, out in outer space, saving the galaxy. But it was done very well, and it was really cool. And as a fan who wanted or would want to see that sort of thing, you got what you wanted. And who else is going to get that, right? Except for fans of Star Trek. So it was really cool. I was happy with it in the end. You know, they did what they did. They tipped the cap to this fucking... Rainbow fucking unicorn coalition nonsense very quickly and moved on, you know. I was ultimately happy with everything that was done, right? So, speaking of like badass graybeards and like astronomical backdrops, right? I got some biker friends, right? I've been kind of in and out and on the periphery of the quote-unquote biker community here in post-Arlen, Texas, for the past few years. And, yeah, there's a meetup at a kind of retro burger joint. There's a couple of them, actually. It's a small chain around Dallas called Meteor Burger, right? There's your astronomical reference. And they do, like... these little small car and bike shows, right? Classic cars, classic bikes, you know. A handful of guys come out. I guess it's every week, and they park. And, you know, a bunch of my biker friends routinely attend one of these. The place is called Meteor Burger, right? That's your astronomical backdrop, as I said before. And then these... badass graybeards are these old biker dudes. So it's kind of a theme. I went last week to one of these events for the first time in a month. I'm kind of like monthly with it, right? These guys are there every week. I'm kind of monthly about it because it's a burger joint at the end of the day. It's mostly the same people pulling up when you're there. So if you've seen the cars once, you've seen them all. They're good. You know, classic cars all done up, muscle cars and shit. It's not a lot in the way of classic bikes. A lot of bikers will pull up and park, but most of them are new-ish. Like I said, they're there every week. I always get an invite from a buddy of mine, and I go once a month or so. See, my fasting is often what gets in the way of this. I typically, you know, when everything is right in the world, I'm not eating during the week. And the temptation is high. You go to a place like that, they got the grilled onions going and the beef over the fucking flame, and there's no smells that make my mouth water much more than that right there. So it's hard to go in there, sit for an hour, hour and a half. Everybody else is eating. All you smell is this all around you. And it makes it difficult for me. So once a month, I just kind of cave in and go. Just for the continuity of the relationships involved. Because I'm otherwise not a part of it. Right? It's just, I haven't been riding much. And I've been busy in the house and tired otherwise. Because I'm a fucking graybeard and I'm all old and everything, right? But I went out and did that, and I haven't really been paying a whole hell of a lot of attention to the biker community scene, you know. Like, I'm not some badass biker dude. I'm not. It's weird. The only time I'm badass is Like after I've made a pot of chili, then I'm badass. In fact, that's something I did over the weekend too. I mentioned about, you know, getting up. I had a little get up and go on Saturday for some reason, and what I did was made chili. And then when I was done making the chili, I started into eating the chili. And once I start eating, I don't really want to do anything. I've become really odd like that. It's like I get so used to being emptied out with the fasting that when I eat something, I get all this fulled up, bloated feeling that just knocks all the wind out of me, right? And this is something I have to argue with myself over in these days coming on. This week I have to try to like solve my life and make sure I'm taking a part in life and not putting food as a priority when I open up the gates to eat. But that's a whole side thing, right? I don't want to talk about all that shit. But like I say, and I'm not some badass biker dude, I'm only badass when I have my chili, which makes your ass bad. There you go. I make some hot Texas chili and it's good and people know it. It's locally known around here amongst friends, amongst the biker community, at least a portion of it on this side of town. And I say biker community, well, you know what I mean to say is you got people that ride motorcycles, right? People who are into riding motorcycles. And the biker community is kind of made up of all kinds. There's all kinds of different bikes, you know, from dirt bikes to sport bikes, cruiser bikes, hybrids in between all those, right? And you have clubs that are built up on the types a lot of times. Some of them welcome and accept all types. You got a lot of the traditional biker clubs, American motorcycle clubs, the MCs often limit membership to those who are riding American-made bikes, sometimes specifically Harleys, but almost always American-made, as opposed to like the Japanese bikes, the Honda, Suzuki, Kawasaki's, things like, or you get English bikes and German bikes, you get the BMWs and the Triumphs, and but most of these, well, anyway, you got all kinds of bikers and you got all kinds of clubs, but the big division. You have the American Motorcycle Association, which has always been like the proper, what's the word I'm looking for? The just a big association of riders and clubs, which I know like nothing about because you don't see much of that around. The antithesis is what's known as the outlaw biker. An outlaw biker, simply, as I understand it to be, and I'm not the expert on this, and anything I say about motorcycles and motorcycle clubs, I'm going to keep it to low-hanging fruit and high flyovers, very general terms, right? The basic premise of what an outlaw biker is a biker that is part of or affiliated with motorcycle clubs that will have nothing to do with the American Motorcycle Association, right? So you're the outlaw bikers when you're cut apart from the AMA. That's the general outlaw biker there. And then within that, you've got other divisions, you know. One percenter, you might be familiar with that term, the one percenter clubs. And again, it's a loose term that has a lot of different definitions depending on who you ask. And I'm the wrong person to ask, but I know some of the right people to talk to. So I got a couple of ideas and shit like that. But just to keep it plain, you know, your one percenter, the idea of a one percenter is somebody who is, it's a dedication level to your motorcycle club and the biker community. That's like where your whole life is centered around your club. That's a one percenter. There's a Diamond 13, which is something similar but a little bit different. These things have origins, historical origins that go way back into the beginning of outlaw bikers out of California. What it's come down to now, though, is it's basically your one percenters are generally dominant clubs. Generally, all right. You got big four dominant clubs in the United States. The Pagans out on the East Coast, the Hell's Angels on the West Coast. You got the Outlaws, I guess it's kind of Middle America, Great Lakes. I don't really know much about them. And down here in the South, the Middle South, the parts of the Southwest, up in the Plains, it's Bandidos. Texas is Bandidos country, right? Those are what's known as the big four dominant clubs. They are 1% groups. To be a member of them requires putting your club at the center of your universe, right? That's a dedication level. There's other 1% clubs, though, whose dedication is also on those lines, but they're not dominant. They're kind of upstarts. They're kind of bucking the system and typically have made enemies with the big four, right? And there's a bunch of those around, too. As far as these dominants go, then you've got the Diamond 13 clubs, which generally denote a level of support club, like the minor leagues of the biker community. Not to say that these are minor league people, right? These are people that are... their dedication is a notch lower than the one percenters, and a lot of them are aspiring towards becoming, you know, proving themselves at that level to become one percenters. It's a very involved community, all right? And this is probably more than I need to be saying about it, because there's a lot of variance to these things, and I don't want to ruffle anybody's feathers that may ever be listening to this stuff. Again, I'm not the subject matter expert. I've been involved, and I've caught a couple of... opinions. And a lot of this is opinion based, you know, and a lot of it depends on what club you're talking about and dealing with. But the biker community in general, it's made up of the AMA versus the outlaw bikers, and the outlaw bikers are made up of dominant 1% clubs, other 1% clubs. Then you got like the Diamond 13 types of support groups, and you've got like riding clubs, RCs, and you've got motorcycle ministries, MMs, and then a bunch of independents. And all these end up kind of being subjugated to the dominant club through a confederation of clubs organization, right? Which I used to be a part of. A confederation of clubs. They would meet, what was it, monthly? There was two different things. And both of them were lorded over by the dominant club in the area. And again, the dominant club in Texas, therefore DFW, therefore Post Arlen, Texas, is the Bandidos Motorcycle Club, right? And they, I think it was a monthly confederation of clubs. It's been a couple of years since I've been involved. And they held some of the meetings over at the... Southern Junction, right? The Cowboy Bar over there outside of Royce City, out in the country. Great place. Great venue for music. And even if there's no music playing, just a great place to be. Great food. Make your own steak on the grill. You know, pick your own, make your own, cook it your way. Fucking put whatever on it you want. Big old Cowboy Bar, pool table. I love that place. You know, I need to go there more than I do. But they were having these Confederation of Clubs and Independents, COCI, meetings over there once upon a time. And I actually got to meet a guy who at that time was the a state senator, right? Texas state senator named Don Huffines, right? Don Huffines. And last go-around for the election for governor, he tried to stage a fight in the Republican Party over our governor, Greg Abbott, right? And I kind of lean towards this Huffines guy. Now, I met him in person. You meet somebody once doesn't mean you know him inside out and everything like that. But just his policies and everything. In fact... trying to remember back to when that election was, and I may have voted for this guy in the primaries. In fact, I'm pretty sure I did. Yeah, but Don Huffines, he's a Texan, and he's kind of maverick. He's been involved in Austin as a senator, and he's got some very strong opinions on what it takes to keep Texas Texas and fix the problems around here. But I got to meet the guy in person. In fact, we had in our club a picture with him that was going around. I don't have it anymore, but I have a photograph with the guy. Anyway, a little side jag there. excuse me. But not really, because I'm talking about the Confederation of Clubs. See, that ends up being a way for the dominant group in your area to establish a network. And what I mean to say is you take a group like the Bandidos, and I don't know what the actual numbers are, right? I was in the news, not me in the news, I was reading through news that were related to a bunch of biker incidents that have been going on this spring, and I think I'll get into that in momentarily. And one of the articles had posited the idea that the Bandidos as a motorcycle club were something like 2,500 riders strong, okay? And I don't know. I don't know how true that number is. Well, just take that number. You look at that, it's like, all right, 2,500, and they're spread out throughout the country, internationally. It doesn't seem like all that much. But what's really going on is there's a network built up in and around that dominant club and all the other dominant clubs as well that actually make their power exponentially greater. I spoke about like the Diamond 13, the support clubs, like the minor leagues, right? I don't want to insult anybody, but like the wannabes, people that actually want to be in the dominant club, kind of work their way through the ranks. And these are the ranks. You got to go through the support club system to be recognized by the dominance, right? So all the support clubs are really part of, well, the Bandidos here, it's called Red and Gold Nation, right? Bandidos' colors are red and gold, and they have their nation, which is an extension of their club itself. All the support clubs, and then beyond the support clubs, you have people who are tied in to their protocol through the Confederation of Clubs and Independence, the COCI organizations, right? The dominance lord over that in their region, and anybody who wants to basically be friendly with the dominant club has got to buy into the Confederation. And then you wear patches that say that you're such and such. So then when you meet people in mixed company in the biker community, you're easily recognized. You and your club with your patch is easily recognized as a quote-unquote friendly, right? So you end up with this massive network of bikers that are exponentially larger than the dominant group itself. But they are all subject to the dominant group, right? And I'm just trying to give like a very high-level overflight view of the biker community. This is specifically the outlaw bikers. That's all I know about. I don't really know about the AMA. I think they might have the Christian Motorcycle Association, the CMA. I've met a couple of guys with that when I was doing ministry work, but I was not involved with them. I don't know what other kind of groups or clubs are part of the AMA. I don't know how that shit operates at all. I guess you'd call me strictly outlaw, right? Outlaw. Now, you got these outlaw clubs like I described. You got like what I call, and there might be another name for it. There's probably some derogatory names for it. But what I call double outlaw clubs, right? First, you're an outlaw because you don't want nothing to do with the AMA, and then you're an outlaw double because you don't want to subscribe to the protocols of the dominant club in your area, right? And I mentioned there's other 1% clubs out there in this world, and other Diamond 13s out there, and just others out there that will not buy into the Confederation of Clubs and being lorded over by anybody, including the dominant clubs. So you get a lot of friction, right? And these kind of clubs, the dominance, and these what I call double outlaw groups, they always seem to have issues. So it makes for a precarious social situation in a lot of cases. But you got that. You got that. And it, with all of them, though, right? Mixed in and amongst all of this biker community, you have got some really excellent dudes, right? And by extension, their girls, their women, their families. There's a lot of really cool and really good people, really solid people, really strong people. It is a society of alpha males at the end of the day, right? Which always makes it a good place to be. But then you get into a little bit of these societal conflations that occur when one group is dominant and imposing its will on others, and others are standing up to them. Then you get, you know, mano a mano. You get fights, you get battles, you get wars, you get injuries, and you get dead bodies. And that's kind of what's been going on at this portion of 2023 so far. It's been what I call a hot spring, right? Hot spring of 23. And it don't look like it has any signs of slowing. Now, I hadn't really been keeping up with any of this stuff. You know, I've been kind of apart and away. Way out on the periphery of the biker community. Like I said, I'm just kind of like popping in every month or so. And I have a friend who's very much involved with this stuff. And when we get together and spend time, we talk about it. But I have not been doing that much. That's why I go and meet at Meteor Burger. And I try to make a point of it every couple of weeks or so, you know, at least once a month. You know, just to keep it all going. But, yeah, I'm way out on the periphery. And when I went last week and I got in conversations, you know, I recognized that some people I knew were in a different club. I didn't even know that they had switched out and switched over. And then I got the story of all this shit happening, right? That's just been going on around the area. Up in Oklahoma City recently, what was it, fucking April? Maybe sooner? I think it was in April. There was an incident up there involving our dominant group in Texas where they had a couple of guys get killed, right? And there was a retaliation for what they tried to do up there down around Houston in Montgomery County. A couple of different like rolling slash drive-by incidents. I think it was a couple of banditos who were heading north toward Dallas on I-45 out of Houston. Two funeral services, which, as I understand, is pretty much a no-fly zone. Like, you don't fuck with people who are going to do that. But what do I know? That's kind of what I've heard around the water cooler. And I think that the funerals that they were going to attend were the ones that were involved with the shooting in Oklahoma City. So as they're going up to the funeral for that, they get mowed down by a rival club. And again, he had another couple of deaths, I think. At least one, if not two or more. Definitely a few injuries. It was two different incidents. Out in Lubbock, And all of these, all right, these are all involving the Bandidos. And I don't mean to put any kind of slant on it, but we're just talking about the dominant club in the area. And they're going to be involved with altercations because that's what they do. They live the life and they maintain the protocols. And this is what it takes to get that done. Out in Lubbock, I think they had two different things this year. Involving two different clubs. I'm not sure about the Mongols thing. I think there was some kind of drive-by with the Mongols, and then there was some kind of incident with the Kinfolk, both in or around Lubbock. At least one of those things happened. I think both. And one of them might have been a different year or something like that. I can't, my story's kind of mixed up. And then now this weekend, this is why I'm bringing this shit up. Just when, you know, the people in the biker community that I know kind of brought me up to speed with some of the shit that's been going on, more shit goes on, right? And over the Memorial Day weekend, we had the, there was a big to-do in a place called Red River, New Mexico, up in the hills north of Santa Fe, out by Taos, right? Up in the ski village community. They do every year. This would have been the 41st year. A biker rally in Red River, New Mexico, and an altercation broke out there involving Bandidos, and another two of them were killed. Three people altogether were killed. Others were shot up, and they shut down the rally, and a lot of people are out of money who invested in it, whether vendors or, you know, bikers themselves. It turns out to be a shit show, and a lot of people are pissed off and disappointed. And that story, all of these stories, never really have an ending to them. Because at this level, in a biker community, there is an ethos built upon vengeance, right? And I've talked at length about vengeance from a spiritual perspective, from a Christian perspective, how spiritually wrongful it is. But in the biker community, it is the way of life. So when something happens, something else is going to happen. And something else is going to happen. It's tit for tat. Any situations evolve and escalate, and people literally die. That's a very dangerous situation. Like I said, mano a mano, you got alpha males being alpha males with other alpha males. And when shit goes sideways, shit goes awry. I can't get into the details of this stuff. I don't know enough about it. I've heard what there is to hear. And a lot of it is jumbled up stuff, you know, hearsay from others. I'm not personally involved, so I don't really want to get into the details of it. I could say it's a fact that, you know, three people died in Red River and at least one other was wounded, you know, shot and wounded and still lives. Those things are facts. I could speak to that. It's reported by the law enforcement out there, and also the guy who survived, the president of another club, got his face out on social media and tried to tell his side of the story, which I personally think, who am I to judge, but I personally think opening the mouth and saying two words about any of that shit is so wrong on so many levels. But he did. He's out there blathering about. And you can go see it out on social media, out on YouTube, places like that, other places. Look for Insane Throttle Podcast and Black Dragon Podcast. Those are two of the people that report on motorcycle club issues in this country. If you're interested in more of that and some of the details, check out their podcast and their production. In fact, that's where I was told to go if I wanted to know more. And So I passed through these places in and out through the years. But like I said, I'm way out on the periphery of it all. I've always been, you know, oddly enough, I've explained in prior episodes how I grew up, you know, in my teenage years, my burnout years. My friends and I were basically bikers. Some of them rode dirt bikes. I did not. I didn't have a motorcycle. I didn't ride a motorcycle. I didn't give the first thought to motorcycle. I never had an aspiration for it. I didn't give a fuck. The actual bikers that I knew, I usually came to blows with. You know, my attitude versus their attitude. That whole mano a mano alpha male thing. You know, in that case, it was some 40-year-old dude versus a fucking 16-year-old kid. But attitudes and alcohol and shit happens, right? I was never actually a biker, nor did I ever have any interest in it. I had a girlfriend who had a friend who was kind of involved at one point. I had a cousin who was married to a guy who I think was one percenter back in Jersey back in the day. I lived like a biker in a lot of ways. I don't want to get into the details of that because I don't want to suggest what a biker's lifestyle is. What I understand it to be, on the down and dirty, for all that it's worth. I feel, as a teenager, I was living a teenage version of that lifestyle, me and my friends alike. Without any intent, you know. We actually dressed like that, carried ourselves like that, but I had no intent of ever being like that. Patches and all that stuff, motorcycles, and hardly, never. The thought never even entered my mind. We had it around us. We just were who we were, and it was very biker-like. I have no doubt about that. I'm not ashamed or embarrassed to say so. But in spite of that, you know, I'm one of the guys, like, you might regard me as like a midlife crisis type of Harley guy, even though it really wasn't that way. I didn't become like middle age and suddenly decide, oh, I got to get a Harley. No, at middle age, I got a Harley. And the reason I did was because my buddy at the time, a guy who I did ministry work with in a church, he ran a motorcycle ministry that sputters at best. It doesn't really grow, has difficulties moving along, gathering people, you know. Most of the people that come into him leave him quick, including me. And I was best friends with the guy, right? It just never really seemed to have wheels. That's a whole nother story. Dude's a good dude, and he tries really hard. And motorcycle ministries in general, they're kind of like at the bottom. I was gonna say the bottom of the totem pole. They're actually like a rung. They're on the totem pole, the part that's like buried underground to hold up the rest of the tunnel, the totem pole. The motorcycle ministries in the biker community are very widely, lowly regarded. Actually disregarded. I've heard so many bad things out of mouths. Not that motorcycle ministry people are bad people. Just people don't have a very high regard for having ministries around them wherever they go to these shared events. When they go to rallies, when they go to COCI meetings, and you know, I get it. I understand it. I don't argue with the fact. But see, that I came into all this through that because my friend basically needed help. When I couldn't afford a Harley, he told me I could. And I went and got something that I could afford that really wasn't suitable. You know, it was still a Harley. But as far as like long riding and shit, it wasn't great for that. But anyway, again, aside from the point, I came in through the ministries. Nobody ever had a regard for who I was with. Or myself either, right? Because I was in the ministry. So I was always peripheral, even when I was actively involved. When I got uninvolved with the ministry stuff, my only connection was through, well, I was, and technically am, an official hang-around with an MC, right? A Diamond 13 MC. And a good friend of mine is a one percenter. I have very trace peripheral contact with the community through that, but I'm completely not engaged with it, you know, not engaged at all. There's a part of me, like, you know, a lot of it is, well, a couple things. First of all, like, where I'm concerned, at my age, right, I just turned 56. Is this my hill to die on? Being involved in a biker community at any level where strife is bound to explode in your face because it's a alpha male world, right? Is a motorcycle club my hill to die on? Now, I've spoken before about dying an honorable death. To me, the only honorable death there is to be had, and again, I hearken back to Star Trek, The Next Generation, Star Trek Picard, right? Didn't mention this, but Worf, right? Probably my favorite character. Worf, the Klingon, always talked about it being a great day to die, and dying the honorable death. Right, and always going headlong into the end of his life with courage and bravery. But I've spoken, what I mean to say, just to throw this in about Star Trek Picard. Yes, Worf was one of the graybeard characters that come back. So now you've got a graybearded Klingon doing all kinds of crazy shit, you know. Kind of funny. A badass character. I like Worf. I like the character Worf. But anyway, at the age of 56 with a gray beard, am I that? I could probably have my moment, you know? I could probably put up a fight and I'd probably die. But is it honorable? Is it the best death that I can do to, say, stick up for a motorcycle club and my brothers in it? Or to do what I know would be the honorable death? The most honorable death would be a martyr for my faith. Right? So I've talked about it some length earlier, maybe more than once. I got to choose the hill that I'm willing to die on. And I find a lot of what's going on in the biker community, the culture, right? That vengeance-based ideology, really, that permeates that culture to be at odds with my faith. I know better about vengeance than my compadres in the biker community seem to do. Now, my friends tend to be not so vengeful about it. My friends tend to be of the mindset of ride motorcycles and have fun, and not be so wrapped up in the dirty business of it all and the territoriality of it all, right? But whether or not the people I choose to associate with are of that mindset, I know the rest of the people, or so many, I should say, of the people otherwise in the community, or in the community otherwise, are of the vengeance at all fucking costs mentality. It just doesn't jive with me. And I don't know that I know, I don't want to die that kind of death. That would be a waste to me. It's at odds with my faith. I know where my faith is in regards to vengeance, and I think vengeance is the key for me when I'm debating over my place in the motorcycle community, biker community, motorcycle clubs. Where does vengeance come into play? And if I want to handle vengeance the way I know to handle it by my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, who taught me about this, is that going to be applicable in so many of these biker community situations that may just blow up in front of my face? And it should come as no surprise that, like, how I have drifted away over the past 2 years from the biker community, even from my own damn bike. I hardly even ride that. Let's just say it as it is. I just had a 4-day weekend of gorgeous, perfect fucking weather. I didn't even look at my motorcycle. I didn't even look at it, let alone ride it. I didn't even go out into the fucking workshop and take a look at it. I have faded far from the biker community, and I've only got these couple of strings holding me attached to it that I've already described. But that drifting from it all is absolutely relative to my conversion into orthodoxy. As I move further and further into my new orthodox life, I have gone further and further away from my biker community life. And I still try to reconcile it. There's a part of me that still wants to be a part of both somehow. I've got a friend who does it, who's orthodox and in the biker community, and I don't know how. I don't know how he reconciles the two. I've asked him, and I've got no answer. I'm hoping there's some kind of orthodox riding club out there, or even an MC, motorcycle club, that is orthodox people, you know? And that's what pulls them together. Orthodox people that just want to ride motorcycles and have fun. And wherever we go, we talk about orthodox things. There has been some suggestion of it at our church. There's quite a few people in the church that do have motorcycles or want to have motorcycles. You know, the possibility of fomenting something like that in the area between a couple of the orthodox churches around. It's there to do. Just somebody's really got to take it up and do it. I don't want to be that somebody. I just want to ride motorcycles and have fun. I don't want to be president of a fucking group. I don't want to do that. I got no time to ride a bike, let alone run a motorcycle club or even be an officer and take part in it, right? The people are there. That could happen. Well, what's definitely out there, and I've stumbled on it a time or two, they've got like recovery, like clean and sober clubs, motorcycle clubs. That's something I may take a look at, a hard look at. In fact, I asked my buddy. We went out together to a meeting last summer on a motorcycles, and there was a sober club there, and I couldn't remember the name of them. He gave me the name, and I went looking up what I could find about them online so I could get in touch with somebody, find out where they're hanging out, so I go hang out, but I couldn't find shit. But that's a possibility also. If I, you know, somebody comes up with an orthodox riding club, that would be cool. I could potentially join in with a sober and clean and sober recovery club. But that's where it's at. That's where it's at with all the biker stuff, I guess. I'm still keeping an eye on those podcasters out there that's talking about these this MC stuff, Insane Throttle and Black Dragon, and finding out more about what's going on. They're on it 24/7. When there's an incident, they're talking about it. You know, but as you listen to it, it's a lot of he said, she said, a lot of hearsay, secondhand talk, telephone tag game or telephone games. But yet somehow it's all very compelling. You know, it says something about the human condition. These stories. It's the same fascination that Jersey people like me have with mob movies, right? I mentioned The Sopranos earlier. Tony Soprano, James Gandolfini, you know, dying, that character not being able to be resurrected unless by another actor, which is almost unfathomable. Why the fascination with mafiosos and organized crime? You know, what is that made of? Where does that come from? In my mind, there's a deliberation that is constantly going on, a battle of good and evil. Right? Led Zeppelin's Battle of Evermore, right? But we have always, we exist, all of us, whether we like it or not, whether we recognize it or not, whether we want to pretend otherwise, it is, in fact, a battle of good and evil, and it's occurring not only in the world around us, but in our own skulls, right? It's our own personal battle, and then it's a externally a social battle, a cultural battle going on. Good and evil, always at hand, always being juggled, always being contemplated. Our fascination with these kind of stories, with mafiosos, with bikers, has everything to do with that. Has everything to do with us trying to weigh good and evil in the balances and somehow discover who and where we are as individuals in the light of it all. I don't know how you all see it. I see it like that. There's more. I see it other ways than that as well. That's not the only way I look at it, but it is a way. I think it is probably a foundational way to look at it. Everything comes down to good and evil. I've said that before. I mean, it's the conundrum that we're in. We have to resolve good and evil and our great conquest in this life is to come to terms with good and pursue good in so much as we become good and leave evil behind. That is the proving grounds of our existence. Are we ready for the afterlife? Where are we going to go? Anyway,
thank you for tuning into Post-Stalin Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Stalin Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at poststalin.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@poststalin.com.